Wine is unlike anything else that I can think of.
Sometimes with all the glitz and glamour of Napa, we forget this whole thing is based on families growing grapes, you know?
Potentially, this is a fantastic year, but anything can change on a dime, right?
And everything's good in life, you just have to make a natural judgment, not be too tricky in your mind. I like it, I don't like it.
Davis himself thinks that it's kind of a big load of hooey. People probably use more than maybe two or three descriptors for a wine. He just thinks they're just making it up.
I kind of fired myself. I mean, I couldn't be a one-man operation forever.
There's always something to do. There's replanting, there's barrels, there's maintenance.
Because so many people use mobile bottling lines right now, and everything has to come, the labels, the corks, everything has to come together at the same time and be there when the truck shows up.
Being able to grow up in wine, you have this passion and love for wine and the culture of wine, and everything else sort of pales in comparison.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 247. This week we feature Margot and Darren DeBordely of DeBordely Wines, Australia.
This podcast is sponsored by Release Winery. Every wine tells a story. Each growing season, it's our goal to create an artisan Napa Valley wine of exceptional quality. Join us as the story of this ultra-limited wine continues. Learn more at releasewinery.com.
You wouldn't expect to find an Italian family making wine in Australia, but it seems many Italians found their way down under, including the DeBordely family. This is our fourth and final podcast from the Australia Up Close event held in Chicago last spring, and for this podcast, we met with Darren and Margot DeBordely. Not surprisingly, another winery all about family. So I'm here with Margot and Darren
DeBordely.
DeBordely.
Correct. Is that acceptable?
Yes, yes. Go roll your R's with the Italian.
DeBordely.
DeBordely, yeah. It's hard to do.
Yeah, it is hard to roll your tongue. It's either that or the Spanish. It's the same idea.
Yeah.
And the name of your winery is?
DeBordely Wines.
How are you doing today?
Yeah, great, thanks. Right?
Terrific.
Great. Nice to have you both here. Thanks for taking the time. I know we have a tasting going on in the other room, and there's going to be a lot of people that want to see you, but first things first. Have you been to the States before?
Yes.
Yeah, been a few times. Actually been to Chicago. I've probably been three times Chicago in my life, yeah.
As a winemaker, have you ever had the chance to check out other wineries in different parts of the countries, whether it be Finger Lakes or whether it be Napa Valley or no?
No, Napa Valley in the very early days, but not in recent years.
Early days being?
Oh, probably 20 years ago.
It's changed a little bit.
Yeah, just a bit. A bit like Australia.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. And yeah. Nice to see Australia working for this comeback, I guess you'd say, rather than anything else, because I've always been a fan of your wines. You make fantastic wines. Tell me about what you are making at your winery.
Well, we're probably best known for our sweet wine, what we call Noble One, and that's using a fungus infection called Botrytis cinerea, better known as Noble Rot, in the Sauternes and Barsac regions of France, which go to make the great sweet wines of France, which is Equem or Ressec or Cuté as examples. And it was actually a 975 Cuté that inspired us to attempt to make a Noble Rot infected wine back in 1982. And that was a very interesting story, because when I first went home as a young winemaking, young graduate from Roseworthy in South Australia, which is Australia's foremost winemaking college equivalent of your Davis, that when I went home, my father said that we get Noble Rot naturally. And I was very surprised by that. And to prove the point, he pulled out a bottle of 958 McWilliams Pedro Ximenex, and Pedro Ximenex, a very thin-skinned variety, gets botrytis very easily. And it was probably the first recognition of Noble Rot in Australia, to my knowledge, and that was from the Riverina, which is where our home winery is based. And that set me on the on a course to make something special. And from 1982 onwards, we started producing Noble One using the noble rot infection, and the wine has become very much an iconic wine with a very distinctive house feel about it. And when I say the house style about it, is we're picking these grapes a lot riper than they would in say Sauternes, so we're going for a very heavily botanized and high sugar impact, and the idea is so the wine is truly unique and recognizable in tastings, and most people, you know, sort of can pick Noble One as one of our wines in a tasting, and certainly when we're comparing the wines, we certainly like to look at the very top chateaus from France from the very top years as giving a bit of a benchmark in terms of production of the producing the style. But certainly it's a very distinctive style, and we use French oak barriques, same barriques they use in Yquem, very tightly grained oak. And the reason why you need very tightly grained oak is because if the oak's not tightly grained, the barrels literally leak like sieves. So you cannot use, for an example, a barrel that may be used as an example for the production of brandy in the production of sweet wines, because with the sweet wines, the capillary action between the pores in the oak means the barrels just leak like sieves. Normal table wine in those same barrels, the barrels won't leak. Put one of a sweet noble one in those same barrels, the barrels leak like sieves. It's really quite interesting. So we specifically have to go for a very tightly grained oak to try and stop that from happening. And the fermentation, the other house style characteristic is our wines, because we're fermenting at such high sugar levels, the wines, the yeast tend to produce a lot of volatile acidity, and that's a very important part of the house style, is these relatively high volatile acidities. And we're talking in vicinity 1.5, getting up to 1.5 grams per litre. Now, with a normal table wine, half that level would be deemed to be a fault. Yet Noble One, with its very intense flavours, is easily able to carry that up to that nearly 1.5 grams per litre of volatile acidity. And from our point of view, it just adds to the complexity of the wine.
I'm done.
I couldn't help but watching you, Marco.
You give me a hard time, will you?
But you know, it's a good answer, because there is a lot of complex thought that goes into making a wine, let alone this kind of a wine, which is so much more difficult to make. This is not a typical wine.
No, it's not a typical wine. And for example, in the vineyard, you can expect your yields in the vineyard to drop by half. And then in the processing steps in the winery, the yields would then drop in the winery by half. So by the time you finish producing these wines, besides the fact they're very hard to produce, the yields are about a quarter of what those grapes would be normally used in making table wine for. So the cost of producing these wines isn't cheap.
Which explains the price tag, right?
Yeah. And particularly, and that's one of the reasons, the higher the sugar levels you're aiming for, the extraction rates drop off dramatically. So when you start looking at the extraction rates, we're looking at, easily 25% of the natural. Obviously, we picked a lot earlier, and then the extractions would be a lot better.
Are you making any table wines at all?
We have vineyards in, besides the Riverina, where Noble One comes from, which is our botrytis-infected wine. We have vineyards in the Yarra Valley, which is very almost Burgundy-like in temperature. We have vineyards in the King Valley in Victoria, which is more where most of the Italian varieties are now being planted in Australia, is in the King Valley in Victoria. And we also just recently started concentrating on the Heathcote region of Victoria. And stylistically, I suppose the styles that are closest to it would be Macaron Vale. It's well recognised as a premium region in Australia, but it really never probably got the kudos that it deserved. And we see it's got a great future, because we're able to produce these very full-bodied styles that were missing in our portfolio.
I guess one of the questions I always run by winemakers is, could you, in a simple answer, I guess, the difference that you see between American wines, other than the obvious Shiraz, that sort of thing, versus the American wines that you've had personally?
To be honest, I haven't had a lot of American wines recently.
Really?
No. They're not widely available in Bilbo, where we come from.
Walk out the door and down the street.
I guess I know, for example, with the Pinot Noir You know, people have discussed the styles they're making here being quite different from ours, especially in the Napa. They're more full-bodied, whereas, you know, our winemaker, who's our brother-in-law, Steve Weber, he really goes for a very Burgundian style. So, and I think in some ways that can be a little bit indicative of a few varieties, perhaps. And also, Cabernet is a lot more popular in America than it is in Australia. Shiraz, Shiraz, Shiraz in Australia. But we need to work on our Cabernets a bit, I think, because we make some pretty good ones.
Make some really good ones.
Yeah.
In fact, what we had today was very, very good amongst some of the Pinots as well. This was a great tasting because I think for a lot of people it was an eye-opener. It was for me, and I've enjoyed Australian wines for a while. Very big difference and a nice range. In fact, for our listeners, we had, I think, what, 8 whites, if I'm not mistaken, to start with?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Yeah, it's a nice collection. Mm.
It was, but it's not typical because a lot of people don't think of Australia for white wine, do they?
No.
But we make some wonderful white wines, and Chardonnays from the Yarra Valley are up there, as I said, very much a Burgundy-type condition. So our wine styles are very Burgundian-influenced again, and that is very much around that purity of flavour, but the complexity. That's also yeast autolysis being stored on in barrels, malolactic fermentation, and basically using all the winemaking tricks that the American winemakers would use.
Yeah, the two Chards were completely different.
They were.
That's the kind of thing, it's always fun to do a tasting like that because people will go, well, geez, it's a Chardonnay. Isn't a Chardonnay a Chardonnay a Chardonnay? It doesn't work that way, does it?
No. Very big difference. And it's a very versatile grape variety because it can be made in very, very warm regions. It makes those very full-bodied white wine styles that is one of the panelists talked about, the Dolly Parton wine style. Very big up front and has a habit of falling over after a few years because it's so up front. But generally, the wines from the cooler regions, they're gonna be around for another 20 years, and they're just going to be absolutely sensational wines when the time comes. But they're sensational wines now with a short bit of bottle age.
Yeah, I think that's what people are demanding. Also, they're wanting white wines with a sort of leaner palate and
minerality is what we call referred to.
I would agree. Minerality would be a big part of that. What about ageability for Shiraz and you know, Australian wines? I'm not sure people think about that too commonly in America.
Mm. Yeah, no, it's an interesting one. You know, when I look at the great wines in my life that I've tried, there's not really that many.
Yeah.
And probably one of the best examples of an aged wine that I've ever come across is probably La Chapelle from the Rhone. And you know, that's just a wine where you've got the basic fruit intensity in the wine itself, they're the wines that are going to age very well. And we don't see that sort of fruit intensity enough times. But obviously in Australia we've got some wine styles that are made with very low yielding grapes, and that helps immensely with ageability of these wines. And also not only the low yields, but some of these vineyards are over 100 years old. When we talk about the Hill of Grace, I believe that's 150-year-old, that vineyard, which is just amazing.
It is amazing, yeah. Again, another thing Americans don't think about is older, you know, vineyards in Australia, and yet there's plenty of that.
I think they know about the old vine Shiraz, but when you think that those vines are older than the ones in France because of the situation they had in France when phylloxera wiped out the vineyards and then they had to be replanted on American rootstocks. So, you know, some of our very old vineyards in Australia, in the Barossa and places like that, are older than
those
vines in
France.
That's
fascinating.
Yeah.
Wow.
It is. That's amazing. I mean, I didn't realise that till we were talking about it the other day.
We do have phylloxera, but it's confined to certain regions in Australia. And Australia is a very big place. It's like having phylloxera in New York and not having it in California. That's because the tyranny of distance. So it's been a major aid in stopping the spread of phylloxera.
Well, it's even the flatland versus the mountainside, because it takes longer to get up the mountain, from what I've heard.
Yeah, it's an interesting little bug, louse, because it can form in the leaves, and when it forms in the leaves, it goes to what they call the winged form, then it can travel very large distances, as opposed to most of the time it just spends its time feeding on the roots of the vine, and that is why it was able to kill the Vitis vinifera, the European varieties, because they were not able to to withstand the Laos feeding on its root system, whereas the American rootstock was, and that's the reason why the American rootstock was used as the rootstock which Vitisum nifera was planted onto.
Well, I'm going to go to a different subject entirely here. The both of you, what brought you into the wine business? How long have you been in the wine business, first thing?
Well, I'm a third-generation winemaker. The business was started by my grandfather in the 1920s. And we've got fourth-generation kids coming through at the moment. Margot, your background is also from winemaking family as well.
Yeah, I have a few winemakers in my family.
Yeah, the starting grandfather was one of the doyens of the wine industry.
In South Australia, back in the 60s, 50s and 60s.
And yet your last name is Italian.
He is, yeah.
She's a Hazelgrove, so sorted stock from all over
yes,
the place.
I know about those, yes. But when did your family come over? Do you have an idea?
1924 was when they first left Italy. So, because the region they came from was the Veneto region, which is...
Northern Italy, Treviso.
Treviso and Bassano.
The blonde-haired Italy.
And really the Mount Grappa, which is the famous spirit Grappa. Mount Grappa is literally where my grandparents came from, was literally in the shadow of Mount Grappa. So as a region, you get a pretty good idea where it was. Frontline during the First World War, economically devastated. So a lot of migration from the 1920s, from all those villages, just a handful of villages all around that region, came out to Australia.
So really, wine was in your blood, both of you.
Yes. Not particularly, because certainly with the Europeans, it was my grandfather a winemaker. Well, they all made wine, you know. But it was just a reality. But it was sort of not. It was a beverage wine that they would make, and along with their small goods to carry them through the winter months. And it was a very important part of the lifestyle. And,
They were simple people. Their wines were simple, unpretentious. It was just to have a glass of wine with the meal. And that's how it started.
Very much a part. You know, the early ones very much treated it as medicine as well. Besides a social beverage, it was also very important in terms of medicine. And when we went to the Chicago Institute of Art, it was fantastic to see statues from the Greek period, Dionysus, the god of wine for the Greeks, and then go to the Roman period, and you've got Bacchus, the god of wine. Mm-hmm. And there's a very good reason these ancient civilizations worshipped wine. It was really the medicine of its time, and it fixed up a lot of ailments.
That's for me. But seriously, you have a great connection to all that in your family history, and then you come to Australia, which, as they mentioned in the seminar, I was not aware that there were a lot of Italians in Australia.
Yes.
Yeah. That was news to me.
Yeah, a lot of Italians, lots of Greeks. The first wave, obviously, during the 1920s was from northern Italy. And the second wave was particularly after the Second World War. Then we had a lot of the southern Italians come to Australia. So whereas in America, it was predominantly the Sicilians at turn of the 20th, late 19th century, which is where a lot of the immigration occurred primarily. So, yeah, the joke goes in the family, we could have been... my grandfather could have ended up in Argentina or in America or Australia, but I always suspect it was going to be Australia because he was the youngest in his family, and Australia is the furthest he could have got away from his native Italy, away from his family. So
that makes sense.
Yeah. And he never returned.
Never went back, no.
Never went back, no, which was interesting. Very wealthy man, could have easily have gone back, but as far as he was concerned, Australia was his new home, and the old country was... for him a lot of pain, so which would have been typical of a lot of the early migrants. Now probably the talk about the clones, I think it's an interesting thing about Australia that a lot of our clones go back to the original collection that was brought out in the 1830s. So the actual predate, the spread of phylloxera, which really started occurring in the 1870s, 1880s, the spread of phylloxera started occurring throughout Europe and then spread to the rest of the New World. But some of the planting material we've got goes back to that original material they had around in the 1850s, and or if not earlier. So the classic example is with our Pinot Noir, we use a clone called MV6. Now MV6 stands for Mother Vine Collection Number 6, And that goes back to the original James Busby collection that was brought out in the 1830s, which we talked about. So when you talk about the pedigree of Australia, you've not only got some of the oldest vineyards, you've also got some of the oldest original clones that are being used in the country. And you've also got some of the oldest wineries, because it's very uncommon to have wineries that are stretching multiple generations going back to the 1850s, even in Europe. Very, very unrare. So,
and this is why people should take the time to try more Australian wines, as well as to learn about them, because there's great bits of history, let alone the idea of 150-year-old wines.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. It is, yes.
For our listeners who'd like to learn a little bit about you and your winery online, how would they do that?
They could go to our webpage, deborley.com.au. Yeah, what is the webpage? I don't know.
Yeah, it's www.deborley.com.au. Yeah.
I have your business card.
I've never had to access it. I wouldn't actually tell you. It's very embarrassing.
I got to say, this has been a real pleasure talking to you both. They're hilarious to talk to, truly, in the nicest possible way. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ray. Yeah, much appreciated.
Learn more by visiting deborley.com.au.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Web design by Jenny Holland. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Photos by Jeanette Herniak. Copyright 2017.